Okay, we're beginning here 10 lines down on the top of Nun Aleph and Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is discussing the reason why we're not motzi'in for achilat peirot, shevach, for mezonot tishav bita, from encumbered property, from nechasim mishubadim. So yesterday we saw two reasons brought down, that by Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, that is only things that are tuvim, only things that are written down, because then they have a kol. And if they have a kol, then lekuchot, buyers can be aware of them and know to protect themselves against such items. Things that are not written, they don't know to protect themselves against that, and therefore you can't go after encumbered property. On the other hand, we saw from Rabbi Chanina that the problem was lefisha ein kitzuvim, because they are not quantifiable. Therefore, we can't have unquantified possible obligations on this individual, because then nobody will buy property anymore, with the possibility hanging out there that they don't know how to protect themselves, they don't know how to assess the risk, because the risk is just not quantifiable. So now, Meiti Rav Huna Bar Menoach, Meitu, if they died, Binotehem Nizonot Minechasim Bnei Chorim, V'hin Nizonet Minechasim Mishubadim, Mipnei Shik Balat Chov. So this is talking about a case that we saw together at the end of Ketubot, where a woman who has had a previous marriage comes into a marriage with a daughter. So now, when she gets the husband to pledge to her stepdaughter that he will support her for 5 years. That husband passes away, or she divorces that husband, and then she marries another husband who also pledges to support her for 5 years. Now, that support for 5 years is not premised on the marriage. It's a complete obligation on the stepfather to provide those monies to her. If they pass away, Meitu, here they all died, then Binotehen Nizonot Minechasim Bnei Chorim, the biological daughters of these fathers only get Mizonot out of free and clear property. That's what our Mishnah says, that Mizonot only come out of free and clear property. On the other hand, he, the stepdaughter, Nizonet Minechasim Mishubadim, comes out of even encumbered property, Bnei Shehik Balat Chov, because she is like a creditor against the stepfather. That pledge for the 5 years is the equivalent of entering into an obligation that makes the stepdaughter into a balat chov, into a creditor. Now here, where she has multiple providers, in that case, one of them will provide mizonot to her, the other ones will provide cash, because it doesn't make sense to provide her mizonot twice over, but she's entitled to it from all of the stepfathers that her mother engaged with. So now, what are we dealing with here? Bishkanu miyado. In a case where there was a direct kinyan from his hand. Now, what's interesting over here is, who is the question on? So Rashi claims that the question here is on those that say that you require ktiva, because the 5 years of the stepdaughter isn't necessarily written down. And so over here you see that she's able to go after encumbered property, even though it's not written down, but it is katsuv. It is fixed, because it's only for 5 years. That's the way the Rashi describes it, and therefore Rashi sees the answer here covering that deficit. Bishikanomi Odo, when he acquired it from his hand, meaning that Rashi says, Vistam Kinyan the Ktiva Umeid, that when a person makes a Kinyan, it should be written down. Whether it is or isn't, doesn't matter, but the actual Kinyan should be written. Very good. So excellent. So Tosafot asks your question and says, I don't see how Rashi thinks this is katsuf. Just because it's 5 years doesn't mean you know what the outlay will be over those 5 years. Mizonot do not have a fixed or quantifiable amount associated with them. Yes, you have a quantifiable number of years, but you don't necessarily have a quantifiable number, and therefore he thinks the question is on both parties over here. Meaning that here you have neither. You have neither ketuvim nor kitsuvim. It doesn't have either of these aspects to it. And then, what's the answer to the question? So Rektosafos also has to see the answer be different, which is not like Rashi. Rashi is just trying to solve a problem of a deficit of tiva through bikanu biyado. On the other hand, what is going on here according to Tosafot? If you look at Tosafot, he says, lekach nira, tekinyan olim tfei miktiva, that a kinyan is better than tiva. Lekach parich, b'no nami nehi diktiva lo mahani kinyan litane. Even if you think that tiva is not there, or not sufficient, if you have a direct kinyan, that is supersedes, or is even better than writing something down. A tiva is something that can be publicized by those that see it. But When you do a direct hand-to-hand kinyan, that is something that will be publicized, number one, because it's direct. And number two is it's clear that the individual pledged by doing the kinyan that he really wanted to enter into this kinyan, and he actively agreed or was maskim to this kinyan. So Tosafot sees that kinyan is being a super ktiva. It's better than ktiva. And therefore, it covers the problem of ktiva. And deficit of kitsuvim, iachi, the Gemara says, banot nami. Why is it only true by the stepdaughter? If he did a kinyan miyado, then it should also impact the daughters themselves. I mean, the daughters themselves may not be written down. And even though we said before, even if they are written down, they're written down only to go after free and clear property, not to go after mishubadim. But nevertheless, if you have a kinyan, according to Tosafot, should supersede everything. And therefore, it should be considered as if it's written down that you can go after encumbered property. Or, according to Rashi, it's written now. If it's written, we should be able to extract for that item. There was a kinyan for the stepdaughter, and no kinyan for the daughters. Gemara asks, my Pascha, what leads you to believe or make such a distinction? I mean, that it makes sense to say that if there's something compelling you to say that the stepdaughter has a kinyan, the daughters do not have a kinyan. Why would you ever think to set up a Mishnah in that odd case rather than have it being consistent between whatever he did for the stepdaughter he did for the daughters? Where it says, Bat ishto davai bishat kinyan mahanila kinyan. The stepdaughter who was alive at the time that he married this woman, so she's there to have a kinyan be made with her. Bito delo havi bishat kinyan. Daughters which are a future item, where he doesn't know if he's going to have daughters, and he doesn't know how many daughters he's going to have. Lo mahani lo kinyan. The kinyan's not relevant to them because there's no gemira to that, because you have no idea. It's all information on the come. It's not something that exists today. So he makes a kinyan with regards to the stepdaughter. The stepdaughter is here and present, and he knows exactly what his obligation is. With regards to the daughters, there's no way to know that information up front, and therefore the kinyan has no bearing on them. Where it says, Milo askina andave tarvayu bishat kinyan. Who says that your case is right? It's not always that the daughters don't exist at the time that he marries this woman. Could be a possibility that he divorces her and remarries her. Therefore, there is both a stepdaughter and daughters involved here. Obviously, she couldn't have married someone else in the interim, because then he could not take her back. It has to be that the stepdaughters from a previous marriage, they were married, divorced, and now they are remarrying. But in this remarriage, it might involve both a stepdaughter and biological daughters, and you could have them present at the kinyan. And what's the scenario? The garshava adra, that he divorces her and remarries her. Elo bito de bitzanai beitin ka'achlo lo mahani lo kinyan. The daughter who automatically gets taken care of in the tanai ketubah, whether written or not, the tanai beitin intervene to take care of the daughter. Therefore, the kinyan has no bearing on it. Batishto, the lab bitanai beitin ka'achla, a stepdaughter who has no rights under the tuba or under the tanai beitin, mahani la kinyan, is using some other vehicle to gain her the mizonot that she wants or the security that she wants, and therefore it's done through a kinyan. Where it says, v'chim migra goro? Wait a minute. Okay. We agree that one is tanai beitin and one is not tanai beitin. But doing a kinyan, why does that make it worse, not better? All it should do is serve to reinforce what already is a tanai beitin. So you have a tanai beitin, and then you have a kinyan. That should be stronger than someone who has nothing and then has a kinyan. So you're telling us just because there's a tanai beitin, it's worse? That makes no sense. It should be stronger because then you have both the tanai beitin plus the kinyan. Ella, bito kevin di tanai beitin ka'achla imar tsarare atafso. Since the daughter eats because of the tanai beitin, let us assume that she already has money to pay for what she needs. In the world of Tubot, we have this chashash. Here, we also enter this chashash with regards to the daughters, which is that he gave them a bundle of money. Or she grabbed it at the time of his death. She grabbed money so that she had what to survive on or what to have mizonot paid out of. So our fear is that since she has entitlement through the tanai beitin, whether it's because the daughter herself grabbed the money or the father gave her a bundle of money, we assume that she might be taken care of. Since she might be taken care of, we won't allow her to go after encumbered property. We won't allow her to go after property that is in other people's hands already. Tosafot here points out that we only go so far as to say she can grab from people who already own the property. But from free and clear property, we will let her collect mizonot. So this chashash, or this thought process that maybe tsarei tafsa, only goes as far to say that we won't let her go after the kuchot, after people who already have the property. But to go after free and clear property, we will let her go, and we won't say, oh, maybe she has the money. So it's just a way to, in a sense, knock her down a level from going after encumbered property and let her only go after free and clear property. And the likely reason being that in a case where there are nechasim mishubadim, there's a loss to a third party. So over there, we will be choshesh for fisat sararei. On the other hand, where she's taken from the Pnei Chorin, the free and clear property, there it's only a matter of the estate, and she's not causing a loss to a third party. Even though there could be other claimants in the estate, nevertheless, over there, we won't worry about this Fisat Tzorrei, and we will allow her to take Mizonot out of the free and clear property. Whereas Vatishto, who doesn't have it through Tnai Beitin, but rather only has it through this agreement, is really a creditor, we don't assume that she grabbed the money. Whether that's because she doesn't have access to the money, or whether that's because stepfather didn't give her that type of money, whatever reason we think that the daughter is more likely to end up with money to take care of herself than the stepdaughter is. Therefore, the stepdaughter can go after encumbered property because she's a creditor, and she's a priority creditor. She came first, and therefore she can take the money away from those lukuchot. On the other hand, the daughters, who we do suspect have some sort of payment or some sort of coverage, therefore they can only go after free and clear property. What's interesting is that Tosafot asked yesterday's daf, when the Gemara asked about the mizonot of the Isha and the Bat, they are written down. And if they're not written down, they're Tanai Tuba that are written down. The Gemara answered, because they are Tuvim Etzo B'nei Chorin. They're written down by free and clear property. They're not written down to go after encumbered property. Vim Tomar Amay Lo Mishani Tzorei Atafso. Why didn't the Gemara give the same answer that it gives today, which is the fear is that they took money already? Why don't we think that that is the suspicion? And that being the suspicion, you don't have to answer that they're written down only for Bnei Chorin. You could say they're written down, but we just don't let her go after encumbered property because we're afraid she took some money already. So he says, V'yish Lomar Dehashta Leitlei Hai Shinuya. He says that possibly the Gemara isn't there yet, but Eino Chanami, once the Gemara gets there, that could have been the answer, because the Gemara only introduces that thought later on. Or, Inami Lomairi Bikanubi Yado, Beleka Lamecha Shemitzarere. It's not a case where there was a direct kinyan. In our case here, we're saying that Kanumi Yado, that there was a direct kinyan from the father in this obligation. And over here, the Kanumi Yado for the daughters means that they probably got some sort of money or some sort of set aside by the father to take care of them. Our case before is a normal case of a daughter where there was no kinyan involved. There's no kinyan involved. We're less suspicious that they have money or they have some way to support themselves in the mizunot. So over here, we worry about the tzarei atafso because there was some sort of interaction between the father and the daughter with regards to this obligation, or between the father and the mother on behalf of the daughters for this. And we assume because of that, he set aside money because he doesn't want his daughters having to go and knock on doors to get money later on or be in a problem for the estate. So he ensures that they have money set aside for them. That's what we worry about, and that's why we don't let them go after the lekuchot, after the encumbered property. So Mara here has a way to distinguish between daughters and a stepdaughter. For Rashi, the whole question revolves around the issue of ktiva. Even though there's no ktiva, we allow her to go after the encumbered property. The answer in the end is, there was a kinyan. Why is there a difference in the kinyan between the two parties? Because the kinyan of the stepdaughter makes her into a creditor. The kinyan by the daughters, because it's a tnai beitin, makes it that he probably gave them some set aside some money, and therefore we don't let them go after encumbered property. Tashma, Amar Rabbi Natan, Eimatai, Bizman Shekadam Mekcho Shel Sheni, Lishvacho Shel Rishon. That's only true when the second individual's purchase preceded the Shevach of the first person. Aval Kadam Shvivcho Shel Rishon, the Mekcho Shel Sheni, if the shevach of the first one preceded the purchase of the second one, goveh minichasim mishubadim, then he can go after encumbered property. So let's remind ourselves of this case. This is the case that we've been speaking about, where B steals a property from A, and then B sells that property to C. C, an innocent victim here, bought the property from B, thinking that he owned the property. And then he, after buying the property, invests in the property, plants trees, gets produce, has payroll on the property. All of a sudden, A shows up and says, that's my field, I'm taking it back. A is entitled to do that because it was stolen from him. B sold the property to C with achrayut, recourse. So C goes back to B and says, give me my money back, give me everything back. As far as the core cost of the property, he's allowed to take that from B, and he's allowed to take that from anybody who bought property from B. Any encumbered property, he can go after it and take it back because he's a first creditor. He's the first creditor because the field was sold to him with recourse. That's only true with the core value of the property. That's not true for the investments he made and for the payroll he made. The reason being, again, we saw yesterday, either because, according to Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, it's not written down, even though we saw in Rashi it is written down, but in a generic sense it's written down, that he will be responsible for everything, but it's not written down exactly what was the payroll or the investment. Or according to Rabbi Chanina, the problem is that enam kitzuvim, they are not of a quantifiable nature. But here, what happened in this scenario is that the buyers only bought property from B after C's shevach was already quantifiable and already known. And that's what right there you're saying. Eimatai, according to Rabbi Natan, when is this true? That's only true if he purchased the property from B before we knew about the shevach from C. Aval kadam shivcho shel rishon, if the shevach of C already existed, the mecho shel sheni, before the purchase of this individual, then the C can go after even encumbered property, because it existed already. Alma mishum delo kodim hu. Sounds like here the reason is because whether the purchases were before or after the shevach existed, before or after that the shevach was known. Had nothing to do with ktuvim, nothing to do with kitzuvim, simply have to know with what is known here. That's the way Rashi reads the Gemara, that here it is a question on both. It's la mishum ktuvim, la mishum ktuvim, but here's a third reason, seemingly, as to why you can't collect from encumbered property, is because it depends on who came first. Did the shevach come first, or the buyers come first? That's the question at hand. And therefore, it's a question on both parties. The problem is that the Gemara is going to answer Tanae, that it's a machloket Tanaim. The problem with that is that the machloket Tanaim does not include this position of Rabbi Natan. So how is this an answer? It's an answer, yes, that we have Tanaim that back up the other two positions, that of Rabbi Yochanan and that of Rabbi Chanina, but it still doesn't tell you how Rabbi Natan fits into that picture. So for that reason, Tosafot says that Rashi's wrong here. The question is not on both parties, but rather, Nira Do'olam Parach Le'ula Davka, that the question here is specifically on Ula, or Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish's Shita, about Ktuvim. Ula Mifshat Nami de Rabbi Chanina Ktuvim Afal Pi Shein Ktuvim. You could also conclude from this that Rabbi Chanina believes you only need quantifiable, you don't need written. Because everybody agrees here, this is not written down, but it is quantified already, because the Shevach is known. The improvements in the property are already known. So it is a quantifiable amount, but it's not written down. From this, Rabbi Natan, you would conclude two things. One is, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish Ula are wrong, that Ktuvim is not the pivotal factor. Number two is, we ask the question, even in Rabbi Chanina's position, if it's Ktuvim, quantifiable, does it also have to be written? You can conclude from here, no, it doesn't. Just has to be quantifiable, not written down. And therefore, Tosafot sees it as a question on Ula, specifically, and a solution to whether Rabbi Chanina requires it to be written down or not, which we would say no. And then, Tanei, it's a machloket Tanaim, and that will defend the position of Ula of Rabbi Yochanan, that they can argue on Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Natan talks about Ktuvim, they talk about Ktiva, and here we have a machloket Tanaim that discusses exactly that issue, whether between Ktuvim and Kitsuvim. For Rashi, what you would have to say is that Rabbi Natan is a third position, and bringing down that it's a machloket Tanaim just gives support to these two positions of the Amoraim, that they don't have to agree with Rabbi Natan. That Tanae says that both Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Yochanan have other Tanaim that they can rely on, and therefore they're not bound by Rabbi Natan. And that's the way that Rashi is going to have to explain it. Tanae hi, it's a machloket Tanaim, de Tanya. In motzim lachilat perot, ulu shevach hakarkot, ulu mazoni shava banot, minichasim mishubadim, can't, just like our mission, you can't take those out of encumbered property. Mipnei tikkun olam, lifi sheen ktuvim. Because of tikkun olam, what is the tikkun olam? Because they are not written down. Not written down means they're not publicly known or well known. They're not publicized. You can't go after lekuchot for that, because how are they going to ever protect themselves or know to adjust for that risk? Amar Rabbi Yossi, v'chima tikkun olam yesh b'zo. Halo ein ketuvim. Just because they're written doesn't solve your problem. It's about the quantity or the quantifiable amount here. The problem here is that these are not quantifiable. And that's the problem, or that's the tikkun olam that needs to be handled here, is that buyers can't protect themselves against unlimited risk. They can protect themselves against known or quantifiable risk, fixed risk, but that isn't the case over here. Look, they're willing to deal with risk as long as they know what the risk is that they're dealing with. If the risk is just limitless, then you really can't deal with that risk. There's no way to price it. There's no way to adjust for it. The way that Rashi explains this statement of halo ein ketuvim in Rabbi Yossi is, ubamei yesh lekuchot lehizaher. And what could the buyers be wary of? Ubalav tikkun olam nami en adin litrof. And even without a tikkun olam, they shouldn't be able to go after the kuchot or go after the encumbered property, because halo ein ketuvim, there was no amount or fixed amount that they should be able to go after. Tosafot does not like that explanation of Rashi, because then it makes it even a question on Rabbi Chanina, because Rabbi Chanina believes that that is the tikkun olam, that they are einan ketuvim. Rashi says inherently there's no claim when they're ein ketuvim according to Rabbi Yossi. And therefore Tosafot explains Rabbi Yossi's statement the way that we did, which is that einan ketuvim is the reason for the tikkun olam according to Rabbi Yossi, just like einan ketuvim is the reason for the Tana Kama in the Braita. So here you see a machloket tanaim along the same lines as the machloket amoraim that we saw before as to what the tikkun olam is in this instance, that you're not allowed to go after encumbered property. All right. V'motzim mitziyah lo yishava. So this is the last line in the Mishnah, which is someone who finds a mitziyah does not have to take a shvuah mipnei tikkun olam. So the tikkun olam here, again, was that if we force people who find avedot to take a shvuah, they are not going to return avedot. They're not going to be willing to engage in avedot because they're going to get held up by the courts to take a shvuah. And people are reluctant to take shvuot in general. And even more so here, where they're just doing someone a favor, they just rather not do it and then not get involved in the shvuah. So mipnei tikkun olam, even though the returning party gives back the item and the owner says it's not all here, there was something else associated with it, we still do not make them take a shvuah. Amar Rav Yitzchak, shekisim shrim atzatzli, owner says you found two money pouches tied together. Bala omer, and the finder says, lo matzati el echad, I only found one nishba. He does have to take a shvuah over there. Shnei shvarim kishrim matzatzli, you found two oxen tied together. I only found one. I didn't find two oxen. Einu nishba. He doesn't have to take a shvuah there. My taima. Shvarim menatchei me'adodi. Oxen are likely to split the rope or the thing that ties them together. I mean, they're active. So there's a reason to believe that even if they were tied together, they may not always be tied together. They may not remain tied together. Kisin lo menatchei me'adodi. But money pouches are inanimate objects. There's no reason to believe that they got separated, or there's no reason to be choshesh that this string fell apart. And therefore, the claim is a good claim. So Rabbi Yitzchak, seemingly over here, argues on our Mishnah and says that this tikkun olam is not relevant. There are cases ba'aveda where you're going to have to take a shvuah, because, as Rashi says over here, Vavale tanoto shelze tanat bari. Rashi says that the goreim here, according to Rabbi Yitzchak, is that you have a tanat bari. You have a definitive claim. The litigant who's coming here is making a full-fledged claim that he is certain about. The other guy says, I only found one. So the tanat bari governs, and we force a shvuah. But that's as long as there's a tanat bari. In the case of the shvarim, he can't make a tanat bari because the nature of the shvarim is to split. So even if he says they were definitely tied, that doesn't mean that they were tied when they were found. And therefore, he doesn't have a definitive claim. So in the case where he has the definitive claim, we're going to force a shvuah. Whereas in the case of shvarim, it's a tanit shema, and therefore he doesn't have to take a shvuah. But that means when you have a tanat bari, when you have a definitive claim, we are going to demand a shvuah, even in the face of aveda. By case of modiv and mitzat, in a case of aveda, Rabbi Yitzchak says, you must take a shvuah. Now, the next part of the Gemara, we have the girsa that Rashi changed in the Gemara, which is that the Gemara continues, and Rashi claims that this is Rabbi Yitzchak's position. It's a continuation of Rabbi Yitzchak's position, but Rashi, in doing so, eliminated from the Gemara Tanya Nami Hochi. We have a braita that supports Rabbi Yitzchak, because he says that this is all part of Rabbi Yitzchak's position, and there's nothing here that is supportive of Rabbi Yitzchak's case, because the case is completely different. And that's what he says here, where the next case is, Shnei Shvarim Kshurim Matzat, you found two oxen tied together, Balo Omer, Matzati, V'chzakti L'chai Echad, I did find two, but I returned you one of them. Matzati, V'chzakti L'chai Echad Mehem, Harizen Nishba, he has to take a Shvua. So Rashi claims that this is a continuation of the statement of Rabbi Yitzchak, which is here we have again a Tanat Vadit. Here we have a Taina that is Vadai, that they were tied together. It's never Tanat Vadait because Shvarim could break apart. But here, the finder agrees that they were tied together. So there was an agreement about this Tana, which basically makes the claim into a definitive claim. The fact that they were tied together, everyone agrees to here. Both the claimant, the owner, as well as the defendant, the finder, says that they were tied together. So now we have a definitive claim, and you have to deal with that. Now when he says, I gave one back, that already is a modeh b'mikzat, and he's got to take a shvuah. So Rashi sees that as being a third case that Rabbi Yitzchak is speaking about, whereas Tosafot says that this is Tanya Nami Ochi. You can see that in the last Tosafot, Tanya Nami Ochi, which we don't have in our Gemaras. That is the girsa that was eliminated by Rashi. That this last line here is Tanya Nami Ochi. So here he says, El Ochi Garsina and Tanya Nami Ochi. Because his claim against Rashi is, otherwise he should be believed with Amigo. There's Amigo here, which is that he has a better claim. He could have just said, I only found one, and now I'm going to return you the one. The fact that he admits he found two and gave you one back, so now he has Amigo. He could have just said, I didn't find two, I found one. Now that he says, I found two and I gave one back, he certainly should be believed. The fact that he tells you all this other information makes it more believable or more plausible that he's telling the truth over here. That's Tosfot's claim. And so therefore, according to Tosfot, I don't understand why you'd have to take a Shavua in this case. There's Amigo here. So he says, Elohaki Garsinan, he says, this is not a part of Rabbi Yitzchak's statement, rather a Braita, which is, Tanya Nami Hachi, Shneim Shvarim Matzatli, Valo Omer Lo Matzati Elecha, Einu Nishba, Nekisim Kshurim Matzatli, Valo Omer Matzati Elecha, V'chizarti Elecha Echad, then he's Nishba. So Tosfot sees that case of the Shvarim as being a Tanya Nami Hachi, a Braita, in support of Rabbi Yitzchak's position. Which is that, you see here, that in case certain cases, you are, when there's a Tanat Bari, you are going to be forced to take a Shvuah when it comes to a Mitziyah. So now, the problem with that, and that's part of why Rashi doesn't like this, is that the Gemara now asks from our Mishnah on that. So now, if it's all Rabbi Yitzchak, both the case of the money pouches and the Shvarim is all Rabbi Yitzchak, then you can understand why they ask from our Mishnah. Rabbi Yitzchak is an Amora. And now they're asking from a Mishnah that it argues on Rabbi Yitzchak's position. On the other hand, if you say Tanya Nami Ochi, that we have a Braita here that is supportive of Rabbi Yitzchak, why are we asking from the Mishnah? You have a Braita, you have a Mishnah, you have two items that disagree. So that's fine. They'll disagree. Who says you have to agree between the Mishnah and the Braita? They're Tanaim, they can argue about it. Tosafot, who does leave in Tanya Nami Ochi, says the nature of the question is, he asks on Rabbi Yitzchak, why did Rabbi Yitzchak support a Braita, not a Mishnah? I mean that, okay, the Braita and the Mishnah argued, that's fine. But Rabbi Yitzchak, who's an Amora, why did he choose to follow the Braita and not the Mishnah? And that's the nature of the question here, according to the Tosafot. The Tosafot read gives actually a different explanation of this Gemara and explains that when is he Chayav Shvua and when is he not Chayav Shvua has to do with the nature of the claim vis-a-vis what the Aveda that he has returned. If the claim comes in that he wants the Aveda returned, then there were two of them, and he comes back and he says, yes, I found the Aveda, but there was only one of them. In that case, according to the Tosafot read, he would not have to take a Shvuah, because he has a Migo that he is believed. Like what Tosafot had mentioned, that since he could have denied the whole thing, and now he's admitting to giving man one back, then he should be believed. On the other hand, if the claim comes after he's already returned one of the avedot, and the guy says, you have another aveda that you owe me. And the guy says, no, I found one and I already gave it back to you. In that case, he no longer has amigo, because in that case, he can't deny the fact that he found the avedot, because he's admitted to the fact that he found the avedot and that he gave one of them back. And because of that, the Migo is blocked, and that's why he's not believed over here, and that's why he has to take a Shvua. So that's what the Tosfot reads. He says the difference in the cases. In one case, he has a Migo because he could have denied the whole Avedah, and therefore he's believed when he says that, I owe you one. On the other hand, if he's already returned one of them, and then the claim comes in that you owe me these Avedot, and he says, no, I already gave you one back. There he doesn't have a Migo anymore because he can't deny the fact that he found the Avedah. And without that Migo, he's not Naaman, and that's why he has to take a Shvua in that case. That's the way that the Tosafot read explains this Gemara. So now, Gemara says, Rabbi Yitzchak, Leitle Amotze Mitziah Lo Yishava Mipnei Tikkun Olam. Doesn't Rabbi Yitzchak worry about our Mishnah, which says that when you find a Mitziah, you don't take a Shvua because of Tikkun Olam? What happened to that? All these cases seem to ignore that completely. And Rabbi Yitzchak seems to be arguing on our Mishnah. Or according to Tosafot, yes, he's arguing on our Mishnah because he's supported by a Braita. But why take up a Braita versus our Mishnah? Where it says, Udamar, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. He holds like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Rashi says over here, he says that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is completely supportive of this view of Rabbi Yitzchak, because Rabbi Yitzchak says when you have a Tanat Bari, it's no longer considered to be Meshiv Aveda, it's in a different world. And so too, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says a similar thing, which we're going to see in a second, that when you have a Tanat Bari, we no longer deem it to be Meshiv Aveda. And that's why Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is supportive of this position of Rabbi Yitzchak. And Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, who is Mishnato Kavnaki, the Gemara says in other places that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's Mishnayot are considered to be clean and measured, and for that reason we paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov wherever he shows up. So that's why Rabbi Yitzchak, despite our Mishnah, would support that position of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. On the other hand, other Rishonim believe that the Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is not completely supportive of Rabbi Yitzchak, because they view the whole case of Avedah slightly differently than Rashi. Not about Atanat Bari by Rabbi Yitzchak, but rather for other reasons. And for that same reason, they see Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov not directly supporting Rabbi Yitzchak, but a similarity between them. And that similarity allows Rabbi Yitzchak to have his position because of that similarity between them. So here, the Gemara says, the Tanya, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Pamim Shadam Nishba Atanat Atzmo. There's sometimes that a person is forced to take a Shvua off of his own claim. Ketzad, what is the situation? Manela Avicha Biyadi. I owe your father 100 zuz. Vechaltiv pras. And I paid back 50 already. Harizeh Nishba. He takes a Shvua. Vzeush Nishba Tanat Atzmo. Here, had he said nothing, he wouldn't owe anything and he wouldn't have to take a Shvua. Over here he says, I owe your father 100 and I paid him back 50 already. So the father passed away. He's going to the son saying, I owe this money. So he tells him, I owe 100. And now I gave 50 back. So all I owe is 50. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, take a Shvua. You're a moder b'miksat. Chamim orim. Einu elokim eshiva veida upator. The son has no idea about this claim. The claim only exists because he stepped forward to tell you about the claim. So the pesha also, a pesha itir. He's the one who told you he owes 100. So if he tells you he already paid 50, you can't believe him about one thing and not the other thing. Then we believe him that he owes 100 and he paid 50 back. Because otherwise he could have said nothing and son would not have known anything. So they're right. There's a Migo here, or it's a Meshiv Avedah. I mean that all he's doing is voluntary. How could you force him to take a Shvua if he's voluntarily obligating himself to pay this individual? Whether it's 50 or 100 doesn't really matter. It's all coming from him. So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Leitle Meshiv Avedah Patur. Wait, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's got to agree with this basic principle that a Meshiv Avedah should not have to take a Shvua. Here is all the information is coming from him. Why should he have to take a Shvua? Many Rishonim point out that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's position is not necessarily identical with that of Rabbi Yitzchak, because there's a difference between Meshiv Avedah versus Motzei Avedah. Our Mishnah is a case of Motzei Avedah, where there's no other evidence to the fact that this individual has the object, and his admission or his bringing of the Avedah before us is what generates the whole case that is here. Other case in Meshiv Avedah, there's already some sort of circumstantial evidence, or at least idea that the object was found and this individual has it. Now the question is, what did he do with it or what did he find? In that case, that's where Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says Meshiv Avedah, if there's a Tanat Bari, is subject to a Shvua, required to take a Shvua. Whereas he might agree with our Mishnah that when it's a case of Motze Avedah, that he would not need to take a Shvuah in that instance. And that's why the Gemara here poses the question only about Meshiv Avedah. And that's why Tosafot thinks that Rashi is wrong here, that the question is not from our Mishnah because it changed the language. And in changing the language, it means something else. And that is the distinction between Motze Mitziah and Meshiv Avedah. And therefore, what they're asking from here is a conceptual idea that a Meshiv Avedah should also be Potur Milish Shalem, nothing to do with our Mishnah. On the other hand, Rashi believes that this is identical with our Mishnah, even though it uses a different language. And the question on Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is actually from the Mishnah. But Rashi sees the question not as a question, well, how could he say this if our Mishnah says this? Because he's a Tana. And the question of the Gemara is not a question on Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, but rather a general amazement as to, does Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov really not hold the Meshiv Avedah Patur? Doesn't he worry about Tikkun Olam? Whereas Tosafot and the Rishonim that we just mentioned, who think that there's a difference between Meshiv Avedah and Motzei Avedah, don't see the question as being posed from a Mishnah, but rather a question in Svara. Why doesn't Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov hold of Migo? Which is that since here he could have had a better claim, which he could have denied the whole thing, or he could never have admitted to anything, the fact that he admits to anything, Migo he should be Naaman. And Migo is min haTorah, and that's the Gemara's question, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's position. There should be sufficient grounds to believe this individual because of Amigo. And then why does Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov compel a Shvuah in the face of Amigo where he should be Naaman? Because he has a better claim. He could have denied the whole thing. The fact that he admits to anything over here is Kameshiv Avedah, and therefore he should be Naaman from that Amigo and shouldn't be required to take a Shvuah. As Tosfot says over here, L'chein yirah deporich, amai lo mehemin b'migo, di bay shatuk, demigo dehavi min haTorah. He could have just been silent here and not admitted to anything. The fact that he admits that he found it, or that he owes the money, that's enough of a reason to believe him over here. Whereas Rashi, l'shitato, and Shas here, says that amigo is not sufficient grounds to be poter a person from a shvuah. And therefore Rashi doesn't see the question as being a question about amigo, but rather a generic or general statement of amazement. How could it be that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says Meshiv Avedah is not Patur? Samarav b'toano katan. The case is that the party on the other side is a katan, meaning that it's a minor who's making the claim on behalf of his father. Katan mide mashasha idbe. A katan's claim is meaningless. Vatznan, we have a Mishnah in Shvuot. Ein nishbaim atanat chereshote v'katan. Can't be compelled to take a Shvuah for a claim from one of these parties that doesn't have dat. They can't make a claim against you and then you have to take a Shvuah to defend yourself. These are not considered to be parties that can go to trial and make claims that are valid enough to force a Shvuah by the other side. So just because he's a minor doesn't help you over here. It's no different than him coming and admitting to it and then having to be Meshiv Avedah. A katan cannot generate a shvuah over here. My katan, the Gemara says a katan here is not really a katan, gadol. It's really someone who's of age. Well, am I korilei katan? Then why do you call him a katan if he's a gadol? To the gavi mili daviv katan hu. Because with regards to his father's dealings, he is a katan. Because he does not have a definitive claim. That's the way Rashi reads it. Because when he's toano, he can never be toain bari. He wasn't there at the time that it happened. He doesn't know for certain what happened with his father. Therefore, his tana is a tanat shema. Ihochi, tanat asmo, tanat acherimu. Wait a minute. If that's the case, it's not because of the defendant's claim that we know about this money. Tanat acherim, vodat asmo. It happens to be that the Tana is coming from the son of the person he owes the money to, and he is admitting that he owes it. Kulu tanato nami tanata cherim vodat atzmo ninu. That's a classic case that's being adjudicated in a court, which is you have one claimant, and the other one is denying or admitting to a portion of it. That's a motive of mixat. Every motive of mixat involves a claim by one party, and a denial, at least in part, by the other party. So if that's the case, what you've just created a classic case of modem and mixed it here. Sounds like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is absolutely right. Then why do the Chachamim disagree and say it's Kameshiv Avedah over here? Ella. Rashi over here explains what the Gemara thinks when it comes to a claim of a katan. So he says, lo tema tono gadol, el betono katan. Case here is not when there's someone of age who made the claim, but rather when a katan made a claim. Udekashalach ein nishbayim matanat katan. If that's the case, that you can't make a shvua on a tanat katan, hani milei bishtono hifkari decha. That's only in a case where he makes a claim that he deposited something with you. The gabi shvua ktiv ki tein ish velo katan. Because by shvua it says when a man gives over something to be watched, then he can demand a shvua. A katan cannot demand a shvua. Aval ba betanat aviv. Over here he's coming with the claim of his father. Nishbaim afilu lekatan. You do take a shvua to the katan. And for the Rabbanon, we won't even take accepted from a Gadol. So that is what Rashi says the Gemara is about to do and say Ella. Ella means, according to Rashi, we're going back to the original answer that we're talking about a real Katan over here. If it's a real Katan, how do you have any claim whatsoever? The answer is that the Katan is only coming with the backing of his father's deposit or his father's action. So the fact that he's coming with the backing of his father's action means that the Katan now has a right to generate a shvua or to force a shvua by the other party, according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. What Rashi sees here is that the Tana of a Katan does have value. And the Tana of the Katan over here is what generates the shvua, as long as the deposit or the transaction was done by his father, who was a gadol. So the claim of a katan can generate a shvua as long as it's backed up by the father's transaction. If it was the katan's transaction, then there would be no claim by the katan because then it can't generate enough force to make a tana. But Rashi sees in this that Ella, that the katan does have the ability to generate a shvua. Many Rishonim disagree with Rashi on this point and say that a katan's tana is meaningless. There is no value to the Tanata Katan. And the reason, as Tosafot says, that the Rishonim don't like this explanation of Rashi is because Ikar Chaser Min HaSefer. The major part of that answer is missing from the Gemara, this whole explanation of how you could take a Shvua on the Tana of a Katan. They don't bring the Gzeret HaKatuv, they don't bring the Pasuk, they don't do anything to substantiate that. And therefore, Tosafot, along with the other Rishonim, believes that that is not what the Gemara is saying over here, but the Gemara remains with this position that we're talking about a Gadol. And so then, when you say Ella over here, Ella means not like Rashi, that we're going back to the original answer that we're talking about a Katan, but rather Ella means we're still talking about a Gadol. We're still talking about a Ben of the Father, but the Ben of the Father has a different standing than the Father himself because of the following, which is what the Gemara is about to explain now. So here you have a fundamental machloket as to whether a katan can generate a shvua, where Rashi says yes, as long as he's backed up by his father's transaction. Other Rishonim say a katan can never generate a shvua, and therefore we're still talking about a ben gadol. He's called a katan, b'milei d'avua, and all the Gemara is saying is, Ella, don't worry about the fact that this is a classic case of modem mixa, where you have a claimant and you have someone denying it, because here the claimant is different than normal cases. The claimant here cannot be like a regular claimant because he wasn't the one who extended the loan or wasn't the one who did the transaction. And that has bearing, as we're going to see now, because of Rabba. Ella bidarabba kamiflege. They're arguing within this position of Rabba. This is a very famous statement of Rabba. We bumped into it already in Ketubot. And Bezrat Hashem will bump into it again in Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Shavuot. It's a concept behind Modeh B'Miksat. What is the reasoning behind why someone who is modem mixat has to take a shvua? Chazakah ein adam meiz pana bifnei bal chovo. A person will not be as brazen to say to the creditor that he doesn't owe him money. A person will not deny to the creditor that he owes him money. Rashi claims because he did him a tova. He did something nice to him. He gave him some benefit. He lent him money without charging him interest. He lent him money without any other obligations. He did him a tova. And in doing that tova, he will not deny the fact that the creditor extended him such a loan. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot does not like that explanation, as well as many of the other Rishonim. And therefore they claim that, what does it mean that a person is emanis panav b'fnei bal chovo? Is that a person doesn't lie to the face of someone who knows the truth. The creditor knows the truth. So the debtor will not lie face to face with the creditor when he knows the other party knows the truth. The psychology of the fact that people only lie when they know that the other parties don't really know. But they won't lie to the face of someone who knows the truth. The creditor here knows the truth, and he won't lie to his face. It obviously has nafkaminot between which way you view it, especially with regards to shomrim. In the case of a pikadon, where you deposit something, do you have to take a shvua? According to Rashi, you wouldn't have to take a shvua there by modu miksad because there's no tova. He didn't do anything nice for him that he would feel bad about lying. On the other hand, Tosafot and many of the other shonim believe it's because he won't lie face to face to someone who knows the truth. If he gave the pikadon to the guy and that guy knows the truth, then he won't lie to his face that he never gave him the pikadon. So this has nafkamina between their reasoning behind why he doesn't lie to a bal chov. V'hai b'kulei by the michferele. And he should have denied the whole amount. V'hai de lo kafre, mishum de'ein adam me'iz panav, b'mnei bal chovo. He should have denied the whole amount, but why did he not deny the whole amount? Because ein adam me'iz panav, b'mnei bal chovo. A person is not so brazen as to deny to the face of his creditor. Now Rashi here reads this as the reason for why kofer bakol is patur. A kofer bakol is patur because nobody would go face to face with their creditor and deny it. And that means that if he does deny it, then he's definitely telling the truth. And for that reason, a kofer bakol is patur. That's how Rashi sees this stage of the Gemara according to Rabba. On the other hand, Tosafot says that this part of the Gemara is telling you why there is no migo that he is believed. Meaning that there should be a migo here. When he's modeh b'miksat, he could have had a better claim. His better claim would be deny everything. So migo that he admitted to a half, we should believe him because he could have said, I owe nothing. And therefore there should be a nemanut to this claim over here. Tosafot says, that's what Rabba's trying to clarify, that there is no migo over here. There's no migo because the claim of kofer bakol is not a valid claim. He would never make that claim because ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei bal chovo. So Tosafot sees kofer bakol as being a gezeirat hakatuv, that a kofer bakol is patur, and the only reason that he doesn't have a migo to be believed here by modeh b'miksat is because kofer bakol is not a valid claim or a plausible claim for him because ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei bal chovo. On the other hand, Rashi says that this is explaining why if someone was kofer bakol, he'd be patur, because ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei bal chovo, if he did it, he must be telling the truth. So then, if he won't be kofer bakol, ubikule bayilu odile, so then he should have admitted to the whole amount. Vaidalo odile ishtimute hu dekam ishtamitle. And the reason he hasn't admitted to the whole amount is because he doesn't have it to pay back now. So he's trying to slip away without having to pay back the whole amount. And so he says, you know what, I owe half, and then later on when I get the other half, I'll pay him back. Savar ad avali zuzeo pranale. When I get the money, I'll pay him back the rest. Vamai rachmano. So the Torah understands this mentality. Rami shvua ilavei keichi delo dilei bikulei. Force the shvua on him so that he admit to the whole amount and not just to the half amount. So for here, Rashi says that the sheet of Rabba is explaining two things. One is, why does modeh b'miksat take a shvua? And why does a kofer akol patur? Kofer bakol is patur because ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei bal chovo. And therefore, if someone does say something, then for sure they're telling the truth. And that's why you're patur by kofer bakol. Why are you chayab by modeh b'miksat? Because of this psychology that Rabba says, which is, he's too afraid or too embarrassed to deny the whole amount. He doesn't have the capability to pay the whole thing, so he can't admit to the whole thing, so he goes to this middle ground and admits to half of it. Therefore, the Torah intervenes and says, take a shvua, because now we're going to get the truth out of you. That's the way Rashi reads this. Tosafot, on the other hand, reads this as being an explanation simply for modeh b'miksat. Because by modeh b'miksat, you have a migo that he should be patur, because he could have denied the whole thing. The fact that he admits half of it is k'mishiv aveda. If that's the case, he should be patur, and that he must be telling the truth, because he had a better claim to deny the whole thing. That doesn't exist, because ein adam me'iz panav b'fnei bal chovo, according to Tosafot, means that a person doesn't lie to the face of a person who knows the truth. But therefore, kofer akol is not even an option for him. That makes it modeh b'miksat, he's not ne'eman. Okay, why do we force a shvuah then? Even if he's not ne'aman b'migo, why do we force a shvuah? That is because he should have admitted to the whole thing and he's just trying to slip out of it. Then Rashi asks the obvious question, which is that if Rabbah is right, then isn't this person choshud al mamona? This person is choshud to lie over here about half of the money that he owes. So then why are we going to believe him by this shvuah? Because choshud al mamona should be choshud al shvuah. That's what Rashi says over here. V'chi teim alo nishbe'e yashara demigo de choshud amamona choshud nami ashvuata amamona lo choshud. He is not choshud on the mamon midolo kafre bikulei. Because he didn't deny the whole amount. The fact that he was willing to admit a half shows you that this isn't a person trying to steal. This isn't a person in normal cases that would steal. He's just in a difficult bind. He doesn't have the money to pay it back, so he doesn't want to admit to the whole amount. So he admits to half of it. But the fact that he admits to half of it shows you that he really is genuine in his desire to give back the money. Now, if that's true and that we believe him and he's genuine in his desire to give back the money, why do we make him make a shvuah? So some of the Rishonim suggest that because if he gets away with it and he doesn't have to take a shvuah, then we, later on he might change his mind and decide that he doesn't want to pay the other half back. So we force him to take the shvuah to establish that there is a full claim over here and to ascertain whether he's telling the truth about this half. But Rashi says because of that, migo de choshed amamona, choshed ha-shvuato is not applicable over here. The Gemara in Bava Metzia goes as far as to say that it doesn't even apply by chuzak kafran. Even if the guy denies the whole amount, he's still not considered to be a thief or a gazlan, not to be believed on shvuah, partly because a shvuah is more chamur to them than stealing, but more particularly because the person wouldn't steal in general. He wouldn't lie in general. Just happens to be he's in a predicament where he owes money back, and in that case where he makes a denial, it's because he doesn't have the money to pay back. Therefore, we can give a reason for why he would lie over here. It's not because he really wants to steal. On the other hand, if it's a pikadon that was deposited with the individual, and then they lie about it, that person is choshed amamona, and therefore the shvuah would not be believed anymore, because there's no reason for him to deny it over there. Somebody deposited an object with him. He should not be touching it, doing anything with it. If it's missing, or if he's denying the fact that it's there, he's just an outright liar. He's stealing the object. And in stealing the object, then he loses his ne'amanut with regards to the shvuah. And that is true of a gazlan as well. So that's why Rashi learns the Gemara over here, that there is no migo de choshed amamona, choshed ha-shvuato, because of the fact that he's modeh b'miktzat. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that that can't be the case, or that can't be the explanation over here, because the Gemara in Bava Metzia claims that we don't say migo de choshed amamona, choshed ha-shvuata, and therefore that's not an issue that Rabbah needs to address. And therefore he says that the modeh b'miktzat over here is coming to address why he's not believed by the kofer b'miktzat. I mean, if ein adam yizpanav b'fnei ba'al chovo, then why don't we believe him about the half that he denied? Because he wouldn't deny it unless it was the truth. So that's what Rabbah comes to explain here, that he's doing it in this partial manner because of the difficult predicament that he finds himself in. And that's why we don't believe him about the other half. Because he should have admitted to the whole amount, and he only admitted to half. And that's what Rab was trying to explain for us. And that's what Tosafot says over here, L'chein nira, da'ata l'faresh lo tema, kevin dein adam yizpanav, imkin kushto ka'amar, bipater mi shvuah, mi oto miksat shekofer. He should not have to take a shvuah because of that half that he denied. Bitam chazaka dein adam yiz. Because you have the chazaka dein adam yiz, and therefore she believed about the other half. Tosafot then asks that if that's the case, then why do we not believe a gazlan with regards to a shvuah? If you're telling me that there is no such principle that if you're chashud ha-mamona, you're chashud ha-shvuata, then how do we deal with gazlan? So Tosafot gives two possibilities. One possibility is that a gazlan is only pasul b'shvuah mid-rabbanan, because he's pasul de'edut, therefore the chachamim also took away his right to take a shvuah, because he's considered to be an eid chamas. But al tishit yadcha le'meid chamas, that you're not allowed to use a gazlan as an aid or allow him to be an aid. So too, the chachamim suspended his right to take a shvuah. That's only midrash rabbanan. Or he says maybe you can be mechalek. And this is what we mentioned before, that a gazlan is someone who is a thief and steals money that is not associated with this case at all, and therefore he is not believed with regards to the shvuah. On the other hand, when it comes to a specific case where an individual might be willing to steal or lie, quote unquote, about the monies that he owes in this particular case, when it comes to the shvuah, he no longer will lie about it, because the shvuah is considered to be very chamur, and he will then come to the truth because he doesn't want to take a shvat sheker because that was seen to be very chamur. So that's why in a case where it's within this particular case, even though he might be lying in this particular case, the shvua will bring him to tell the truth. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a gazlan who has no problem stealing money, not only in this case, but in general, then we're not going to believe his shvua because just like this person had no compunctions about taking other people's money, he's also going to have no problems with taking an shvua over here. This is a person whose behavior demonstrates that they don't have a moral compass or that they don't have any fear of doing the wrong thing. And therefore, for them, a shvua sheker will be just as problematic as the stealing that they did before. So that way, Tosafot differentiates between a gazlan and these cases here where a person's trying to wiggle out of having to pay back money. And therefore now the machloket here between Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim is, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov savar, lo shna bo, velo shna bibno, eino maiz. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says that doesn't matter if it's the original party, the one who originated the loan, or his son, the borrower is not willing to be maiz, does not want to deny something that was done. Bilkach lav mishiv avedohu. Therefore when the son comes with the claim, that's not Meshiv Eida. The son's claim is strong enough to push this person to a point where he won't lie. And since he won't lie to that individual, now we're stuck in a position where the Modeh B'Mitzvah is telling us something about this individual's relationship here and why he wasn't Kofer Bakol or why he didn't admit everything. And that's the whole discussion that Rabba just brought to our attention. The Rabbanan Savrei, Bohu Deinu Meiz. That's only true when you're dealing with the actual originator of the loan, the father. But by the child, he has no compunctions about lying to him because either going to Rashi, he didn't do him the Tova, or going to Tosavot, he doesn't know, so he doesn't worry about it. And the fact that he didn't take up the possibility of being Kofer Bakol, so that shows you that he must be telling the truth. Migo, that had he said Kofer Bakol, he would have been Patur. There should be Neman here where he does Mode B'Miktzat. And so that's why the Rabbanan see this as a Meshiv Aveda. So that will explain the difference between Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim, that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov thinks that whether it's the father or the child, that the Ta'ana is strong enough that the other party will not deny it completely. That's the case. He doesn't have a Migo to be believed. And that's why according to Rabbi, he's going to have to take a Shvua in both of those instances. According to the Chachamim, says that idea of in adam is panei b'chovo is only applicable to the father, not to the son, then the din will be different. With regards to the father, he'll be a modu miksa and have to take a shua. In the case of the son, he'll be a meshiv aveda and be under the rules where he won't have to take a shua because the son's claim wouldn't do anything to stop his denial. Now, in the conclusion of Reb Elazar ben Yaakov, he's slightly different than what we thought he was when we started out. That Reb Elazar ben Yaakov says that this isn't a case of Meshiv Eida, not that in a case of Meshiv Eida that you would take a Shvua, because he just says this is not considered to be Meshiv Eida because he wouldn't be Kofer Bakol here. So in the end, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is not necessarily supportive of that position of Rabbi Yitzchak. The Rabbeinu Tam asks on this Svora that is mentioned here in the Gemara that Ein Adam Meiz Panav Al Bal Chovo, because the Gemara in Shvot, Rav Nachman institutes something called Shvuat Heset, which means that even when a person is Kofer Bakol, he has to take a Shvua. And that's based on another Chazaka, which is Chazaka, that a person doesn't make a claim unless there's something there. I mean, if there's smoke, there's fire. If someone's coming to court to make a claim, there must be some credence to the claim that they are making. And that's why we force someone, even when he's Kofer Bakol, to take a Shvua. Well then, how does that match or balance with what we're saying over here, that Ein Adam Meiz Panav Bifnei Baal Chovo? So Rabbeinu Tam, in one answer, like the Shita da Tosafot, which we mentioned here, Tosafot, the Shita to, that Ein Adam Meiz Bifnei Baal Chovo is only to take away the Migo aspect of it, not to override the Chazaka, that if a person makes a claim, that there must be something to it. And that's why there's a Shvut Hesait. The second answer that he gives, which seems to me the more likely answer to this point, is that Shvut Hesait was only instituted much later by Rav Nachman. The original halacha of Modeh B'Miktzat was that you were chayev shvua, kofer bakol, you didn't have to pay anything because Ein Adam Meiz Panav Bifnei Baal Chovo. Rav Nachman saw that either the people in his generation didn't have that embarrassment and they were meiz panav b'fnei bal chovo, or they basically learned the system that if you were denied the whole thing, you would get away with it without a shvuah versus modem mitzvah. And so what people started to do was be kofar bakol, even though it was uncomfortable, but they knew for sure that way they wouldn't have to take a shvuah and they'd get out of the problem. So Rav Nachman put in place the shvuah d'seit to block that avenue of escape for people who were denying things just to get out of it. So even though ein adam meiz panav b'fnei bal chovo, once that becomes the only avenue of escape because you closed the modem mitzvah avenue, then people started to use it, even though maybe they wouldn't be meiz panav, but here they were stuck in a bind. So Rav Nachman put a shvuah there to block that outlet as well, so that people would be forced to admit what they owed. And which type of ben that we're speaking about here, again, goes back to the machloket Rashi and Tosafot that we saw earlier, as to whether the Tana here is a Tanat Katan, literally a Katan, or a Tana Vagadol, Katan b'makom aviv. And therefore there are Rishonim who say that the Chachamim here only argue about this issue of b'meiz, b'ifnei b'no shel ba'al chovo, might only apply to a Katan, a real minor. But if he was a gadol, then maybe the Chachamim would agree to Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov that he would not be meiz panav b'fnei the ben of the Baal Chov when he's a gadol. Rashi makes it clear that there's no difference for the Chachamim between whether he is a gadol or a katan, and therefore they believe that he's only not meiz panav b'fnei Baal Chov, but he is meiz panav b'fnei b'no, whether he's a gadol or a katan. That way you come out with three different shitot with regards to this conclusion, whether it's speaking about any son, whether it's speaking only about Gadol like Tosafot, or it's only speaking about a Katan like the Ramban, who takes up partially that position of Rashi. Okay, we're going to stop here at the end of the Gemara on Nun Aleph Amud Bet.